I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Current Geek, the film festival edition of Current Geek, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson, and he's Tom Merritt. And this week, we're talking about the film The Maltese Falcon, Tom.
Oh, yes. Film, Scott. Film. Not just a movie. It's a film.
It is a film.
It's one of the greatest films of all time. It's also our 20th film that we've been talking about on Current Geek.
Wait a minute. No. Really? We hit 20 of these? That's crazy.
This is the 20th Current Geek Film Festival movie.
That also means we've had... Does that mean we've had 20 autopilots as well since we started doing that at the same time? Probably.
I mean, I can't remember if we... Did we start doing autopilot immediately? Because if so, then yeah.
I think it was at least right around the same time that we decided to...
Autopilot must be at least 19, yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool. I like that. And it's a fitting film for that. I feel like this is a... This is a high watermark to hit your number 20 on, this old ass movie, which I just get it out of the way now. We're just going to say it now and never bring it up again. Everybody in this movie and everyone who made it, dead.
I got sort of confused. I was looking up John Huston
just
to refresh my memory of all the stuff he did. And he was an actor in quite a few things, as well as a director. And it said upcoming projects. And I'm like, he cannot be still
alive. There's no way.
And so I look it up. I'm like, no, he died in 1989 or whatever. But I guess they're using his voice or his image or something in something. And that's why I'm like, wait a minute. Is this a weird exit? No, it's not.
That half documentary slash actual finishing of film thing that is They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is that Orson Welles thing on Netflix. And I don't even know how to describe it. It was very weird. I watched it. But it was a movie that he'd never finished. And John Huston is in his movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably a recent credit there with a weird date on it. So there's probably a lot of reasons why you
that might have been it, actually. I don't remember what it was. I just saw the upcoming projects. I'm like,
but they're all gone, man. All of them. This was 1941. Yep. There is nobody still around. And
it's not even that big of a cast either. So
no, unless there were some kids and I didn't see any kids. Yeah, that's the other thing. This was my first viewing of Maltese Falcon. But for whatever reason, I thought this was a bigger party, like more people in it. And it's pretty claustrophobic. It's like six people at the most. And they're all sort of hanging in the same places. And there's not a lot of there's no big cityscape shots or any kind of travel montage or any of those things you usually see in a movie that sort of pads things out.
No, this is all done on the lot. In fact, some of the scenes I'm like, oh, yep, that's definitely the Warner lot. Check that out. Look at it.
Right.
There it is. Because if you look real close, if you squint, you can see the same lot that is in the Gilmore Girls is where he's walking down the street in San Francisco.
Oh, weird.
But that said, I mean, this is one of the earliest examples of film noir, certainly arguably the most iconic example of film noir, but not the most quotable. Usually when we're watching these, like Casablanca, Godfather, there's moments where like, oh, right, that's where that line comes from. The only one that I had that reaction to in this rewatch was the very end when he says the stuff that dreams are made of. Mm. I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. That's a famous line, but pretty much everything else is like, they're great. They're great 1941, you know, film noir-ish lines, but they're not memorable. They're not ones that have permeated into our lingua franca.
Yes, I agree. And also even it has a couple of faces that are synonymous with the genre, like Humphrey Bogart and like Peter Lorre, but it still doesn't have all those moments where you're like, ah, yeah, that movie, everyone knows it. Even if you're a kid today, you've heard that line before.
I mean, everybody's heard of the Maltese Falcon, but yeah, name a quote from it. If you don't know that's the stuff the dreams are made of, then you probably can't think of one.
Now, would you say, this is jumping ahead a tiny bit, but would you say that this is one of the first films I tried to find other examples, and it was kind of hard for me to find them. One of the first films where the object of everyone's desire, the actual title of the film, turns out to be a MacGuffin. Like that,
yeah.
That bird is means nothing in the end.
It's yeah, it's not even the bird, or is it?
Yeah, or is it?
You know, I had this weird feeling, and I know I'm confusing it with a different movie, that the bird had microfilm in it.
Oh,
which
right.
is silly, because I don't even think in 1941 they used microfilm yet.
Yeah.
But I kept thinking, like, wait, isn't there something in the bird? Isn't there something hidden in it? No, definitely not. It's just the bird, and it's not even gold. And there's a question of whether there ever was a bird. If you're curious, this is not based on any real situation. It's based on the book, The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. And it's, you know, loosely, according to Hammett, based on some legends from the Holy Roman Empire way back in the day. But mostly it's just a MacGuffin. And it's the title of the movie, like you said.
Yeah, I like that's an odd thing. And I don't remember other movies doing this that are this old. I also have a memory, despite never seeing the film in full. I've seen bits and pieces, and I've seen the scene where the bird gets whipped out. That sounds bad. Somebody pulls out the Maltese Falcon, right, and starts chipping away at it. I remember that, but my memory was that they busted it open.
Yeah.
Like an egg, and there was something in there. And
there must be either a similar movie or a parody or something where that happens. Because, yeah, all they do is they take a knife to it and scratch it, and Sidney Greenstreet is like, it's a fake.
Yeah, it was like a recent example is Lost, which may seem like an odd one, but do you remember when Charlie found all those Jesus statues or Mary statues, whatever they were?
Mm-hmm. Right, and then bust them open and find the heroin.
Yeah, and everyone thought at first it was, what a weird thing.
Spoiler.
Plane full of these porcelain ornate dolls. What is that about? And then you realize later, oh, they're full of heroin. It's a small, in that case, it was a very small plot device, but I was sure that these were cracked open and what mattered was what was inside of the bird, not the bird. And that didn't happen. And I was kind of left a little bit like, oh, that doesn't get broken open? We're done with the bird now?
Yeah. Like, you know why?
Yeah.
Because it's the stuff that dreams are made of.
What's in that bird? It's stuffed with the stuff that dreams are made of.
Yeah, no, there's nothing in this bird. No. It was always a fake. And if there's a weakness to this plot, it's you know, this isn't literally the Dashiell Hammett book, but it's very close to it. And if there's a weakness to the plot, it's that anyone believed that the Maltese Falcon was really the Falcon without getting an actual look at it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm willing to pay $5,000 to get something that they'd never even seen, believing like, oh yeah, no, it's totally the bird. Like, yeah, if somebody offered me $5,000 for that, wax version I bought in Malta one time when I was visiting, I'd be like, yep, sure. No, it's definitely the bird.
Yeah. And there's some, you could say, well, could you make this movie today? And would it be any good? Because that concession that it's not real and that they were all pining after something that was beyond what was actually possible. And murder got him, you know, everybody's killing each other and paying way too much money and all this other stuff. Like, you could remake it today, but I think the conceit is already gone because A, we already know it. And B, millions of movies have been sort of patterned after this now. But I do think there's room for a plot where the item in question, can be used in this way where it's a pivotal thing and the entire movie wraps around it. It's a bit like Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, yes, it was about other people, but really at the end of the day, it was about getting this Ark and the mysteries of the Ark and the Ark being ultimately untouchable. And then we're so greedy, we still kept it and tucked it away in a warehouse. Like, I like movies where an object plays such a crazy role in the film. And so I feel like we don't have a lot of those anymore. Like, we, even in the latest Marvel films in the MCU universe, the use of the Infinity Stones, those are kind of that in comics. They're like these mysterious, hard to get, hard to find. Everybody wants them. Once
and
you get them.
They're used in the movies, like in Thor Dark World, the reality or the ether is used as a MacGuffin, right? It doesn't really do anything in the movie. Same thing with the Power Stone and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
Doesn't ever really do anything. I guess it's used once at the end and it's sort of pivotal, but the point is the pursuit in all of these cases. And the Maltese Falcon is obviously never used. It is not an Infinity Stone.
No.
There will not be any spoilers in the Maltese Falcon for Endgame. Don't worry. But it doesn't matter whether it's used or not. The point is the journey. It's the search. It's the suspicion. It's wondering if Sam Spade is a good guy. I mean, the movie's a little bit spoiled for all of us because we all know Sam Spade is the detective and he's a good guy, right?
Right.
Like, we just kind of know that going in, even if we've never seen this movie or ever read Dashiell Hammett. But they do a good job of making you wonder, like, wait, he's sort of just out for himself, right? Like, maybe he's going to steal the Falcon for himself. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. And in the case of, so you brought up Sam Spade. This is interesting. My exposure to him is very different. I didn't come from Maltese Falcon. It came from listening to old time radio shows. Like mm-hmm. the Sam Spade Mystery Hour or whatever it was called.
Right.
And it was very similar in tone. A lot of, she walked in my office and brought me a cup of coffee. And then we spoke about the, like, it's very much that noir thing, which it definitely has its roots in radio drama. But I always just thought that
the Dashiell Hammett novels are that, right?
Right, right?
I knew when this dame walked in, I was in trouble. You know, that comes right out of Hammett. Raymond Carver and Dashiell Hammett are the pinnacles of that.
Yeah.
And that's why you see Humphrey Bogart, you know, playing The Big Sleep and Maltese Falcon, because Humphrey Bogart is the pinnacle at playing those characters, those detectives from those authors. And so, yeah, of course, you spin that out into a radio show at that time if you've got access to Dashiell Hammett. So it's interesting and very telling of you, Scott, that your first exposure to Sam Spade isn't some like 80s movie. It isn't some documentary or parody, but actual old timey radio broadcast. Yeah. That's very Scott Johnson.
Yeah, which I love. I love those, as you know. In fact, before the shows, when we're just sort of in wait mode and on Twitch, I play those.
I just
shows.
Said Raymond Carver. I meant Raymond Chandler.
Oh, I know you meant. Yeah. That'll totally work. I say Carver and it makes me want steak because we have a place around here called Carver's.
Well, Raymond Carver is also a great novelist, but yeah. not the same.
You actually ate at Carver's with us once. Do you remember that?
Back in like 2011 or something? I still remember that. Yeah. I could taste that steak.
It's like 9 years ago. Anyway, yeah. Yes, to come back around to that idea of you know, origin of all of this, for me, it was a revelation watching this movie going, oh, that's Sam Spade. Okay, they're taking something. I try to put it in modern context, and I keep going back to MCU stuff because we're in the thick of all that right now, but you know, it's a lot like that. It's like, what's the other popular culture that this came from? Well, pulpy novels a dude wrote that turned into radio dramas, and now we're going to bring him to the big screen. And they don't make a lot of fanfare about it, but that's not all that different than comic books to kind of a, you know, maybe a crappy TV show about Spider-Man, and eventually we get real Spider-Man. And I wonder if that's how people saw this. Like, did it have that kind of fandom where they... really,
yeah. I mean, Dashiell Hammett was a huge author, right? And in the trailer, they mentioned, like, yeah, this is the same guy who brought you other great stories that we've told you before, because other of his books had been made into movies. And Sam Spade was pretty famous as a character. Mm-hmm. Also, it's the third time someone made the Maltese Falcon into a movie.
Oh,
it was first filmed in 1931 before the Hays Code went into force, so it's a little racier. It's a little more suggestive. I mean, I don't think we'd consider it terribly racy by modern standards, but by 30s standards, it was, you know, a little more allusions to nudity and sex, or not nudity, but to sex and even homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And then it was made in 1936 after the Hays Code as sort of a light comedy called Satan Met a Lady. And I guess that didn't work as well. So Warner was like, you know what? Well, we can't re-release the first one because the Hays Code won't let us.
Yeah.
Right. We can't get it through the censors. So let's just make it again. Yeah. And we'll ride the line of the code and get it out there. So you get a few veiled allusions here and there. And you're like, well, what else do I have to offer you? And then he kisses her. It's like, oh, I guess we know what, you know, yeah. nothing terribly explicit. There's arguments about whether that line about tell your boyfriend to lay off is actually meant to be sort of a veiled allusion to homosexuality. Maybe, maybe not.
Oh, I wondered about that. Yeah.
But it's definitely, as they say, up to code. Mm. And, you know, I hate to make an argument for censorship because I think the Hays Code was probably overdoing it. But it led to this, which is a classic, which is one of, you know, they may not have tried to remake the Maltese Falcon. And it not only starred Humphrey Bogart in one of his most iconic roles, but started the partnership of John Huston. Mm-hmm. It was his first direction. He wrote the screenplay and he would go on to do The African Queen and The Treasure of Sierra Madre and Key Largo with Bogart, you know, and just make all these great movies. So, you know, you could always play What If, but it is interesting, like, because they were like, well, we can't re-release the old one. I guess we'll make a new one. We get this amazing movie.
Yeah. John Huston, of course, most famous probably for his Westerns. he was your top name in the heyday, the golden age of cinematic westerns. And I don't know if this felt like a weird offshoot to people in the way that like a serious Spielberg movie first felt, or I don't know, people that just stay in their genres.
Well, this was Houston's first movie, so it felt like, who is he?
Oh, good point. Yeah, I hadn't realized it was his very first film.
This is what happened was he's made westerns, and people are like, oh, a Maltese Falcon guy can make a western too. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Because right after that, we didn't get into the western stuff till way later in his career.
Right.
Yeah, here's his director stuff. Oh yeah,
I like to think of him as John Huston, you know, the director of Annie.
Well, okay, but this is kind of a compliment to the film, because the film looks great. Like, doesn't feel like his first work. Doesn't feel like the oldest movie on his resume. It feels, I don't know, they get the contrast right. They get the scene shot right. There's great angles in this thing. I feel like we talked about this a little bit with Casablanca, but I feel like this movie's really got it going on with the visuals.
No, and I think that's one of the things I texted you this earlier today. The Maltese Falcon may be my favorite movie visually.
Mm.
It's just pretty to watch, and the angles are great and inform the story way more than the dialogue. And so when I say it's not as quotable, you don't hear people quoting the lines from the Maltese Falcon, I didn't need it.
Yeah.
You know, John Huston, he wrote a tight story. It mm-hmm. never drags. You're always wondering where it's going next if you haven't already seen it. And it's shot beautifully, you know, with these angles that shoot from above that make Sidney Greenstreet look imposing, and these interesting cuts to emphasize, you know, to kind of point you where to look, like, hey, look over there, see what's happening over there. And, you know, it's film school textbook stuff. They use this movie to teach people the vocabulary of cinematography for a reason.
Yeah, it really is something, and it defines that genre, the, you know, kind of film noir genre in a way that I don't think anybody maybe even had up to that point. And it makes me wish that film noir would be a bigger thing now. I know it has to evolve and be different now. I know it has to be edgy now to be taken seriously, but I wouldn't mind a... And there have been films here and there that do this, but I wouldn't mind a movie that's a bit like this, but with modern tropes and modern.
Well, that's the trick with film noir. You can make a film noir. What was that? What was the comic book? I'm blanking on the name of it. The comic book movie that was shot frame for frame from the comic book.
Oh, no, I know this. The Sin City.
The new name of this podcast is Two People Close to 50. Try to remember names of things.
Sin City, right? The Sin City thing?
Sin City. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sin City.
Yeah.
Sin City is probably the most recent example of a true modern film noir I can think of.
Yeah.
Because what happens when you try to make a film noir now is you either have to make it period to capture the accoutrement, right? The fedoras, and the art deco everywhere and everything. And then it feels a little like a parody,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels like you're doing a period piece. It doesn't feel film noir anymore, because part of what made film noir amazing is it felt present. It felt real. Or you make it modern and then it doesn't feel film noir because it doesn't have the art deco and the, you know, it doesn't have the style. It's like, oh, you're just making a gangster movie now, or you're making a cop film now. And yeah, it's kind of film noir, but if it's color, it kind of loses the film noir flavor right away. So it's really tough to ride that line between keeping the style of film noir, but somehow updating it and not falling into the just looking like, oh, you're trying to make a movie that's set in the 50s or 40s or 30s.
I think Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049 are good examples of
modernization
of the idea. I mean, obviously it's mixed with sci-fi.
They definitely have great film noir veins running through them.
Yeah. Even the director's, or the cut that no one likes that they got rid of has voiceover that's just like, you know, Sam Spade talking about his morning. And they got rid of that, but still, like, it kind of feeds into that. Other movies I would probably throw into this category, like Memento, is very, very film noir. Brick. I don't know if you've seen Brick. Ryan Johnson film. Oh, Brick is so good. Brick is good. And you know what? Brick is, it's set in high school, and a mystery within high school, but it's done in the style of the Maltese Falcon or 100 of these other kind of noir films. You should see Brick, Tom. Brick is interesting because it's like they're doing exactly what I'm saying. It's almost, you know what it's more like? It's it's like that Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio that's like everything's modern, but the dialogue is still Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's a it's kind of like that's like what that feels like. It feels like, oh, this is like traditional noir, but they're doing it in a high school in 2005 or whatever the year was.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. Real good. That's when everybody knew Rian Johnson had something to say. Even if
I would like to see Marvel do a film noir.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Who would they do?
I'd like, we were watching Captain America Winter Soldier last night, and I was like, oh, right, this is an action movie,
mm-hmm.
right? This is, you know, other than it being Captain America, it's an action movie, and it's a great action movie. And Guardians was kind of a comedic romp, kind of, you know, like, and it was one of the things that Marvel did so well is our movies aren't going to continue to be superhero movies every time, right? They're going to be mystical movies, or that we're going to explore the genres within that universe. And I'd love them somehow to do a noir movie. And I don't know what the best, I mean, Mysterio's kind of good for that, but it doesn't look like that's their take on him in the Spider-Man trailer.
I mean, they could do a full-on spinoff of Spider-Verse and go straight Spider-Man noir. They could go, I mean, that feels a little too on the nose and a little too parody.
But yeah, now that we've established him and into the Spider-Verse, maybe it would work.
Might work, but I'm kind of thinking like, gosh, I don't know what it would be. Like, there's that one with Tom Hanks that I can never remember the name of that was super great. It was based on a Dark Horse comic and I loved it. It was mob movie, but it definitely had noir tendencies to it. And I can't remember it in the chat room. So I'm
Yeah, no.
Road to Perdition.
That's it. Road to Perdition.
That's a fantastic, I think, a good example of this. But it cheats because it sets itself in the timeline. Like it puts itself in the 30s or 40s.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it does a great job of doing that, but it does it in the space it's just a little bit of a conceit or a cheat. So you know what? In the end of this, I guess what I'm saying is I like the tone and the stuff that people like Christopher Nolan do really well. Even you can even say The Dark Knight is kind of a film noir movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
So you can say that we have modern
maybe
examples.
DC is just better at film noir.
Maybe. But
I mean, Watchmen too.
Oh yeah, Watchmen's a good example of that. In fact, the Watchmen series coming to HBO could be real. That has a chance to be something special if they can pull this off.
Yeah, for sure.
It might be terrible, though, but it might be great because...
Yeah, well, it's going to be one of those.
It has to be, right? There's no in between for this.
Because those are the two categories
you got one
set
shot
up for it to be.
You got one shot to get this right, and Rorschach is your perfect noir detective.
He's very... Yeah, no, exactly.
Like, all that stuff's set up to be really great. But anyway, back to this movie. It's a thing of its time, and I guess this viewing really... roped me in on it in a way that I haven't in a while. I already respected it. I like it for what it is. I like the cheesiness of it even. But I haven't seen anything recently that was like a lot like this. And this is just like pure out of the tap film noir 101 from beginning to end. And it's got the sarcasm and the wit and the humorous moments and the women who just, you know, none of these women are in control, man. They just, the 40s were sure that women just couldn't keep it together. And so they got that going.
Well, with the exception of his secretary.
Yeah, she's great. She's great.
She's on top of everything.
Yeah.
Like she basically is behind the scenes making all of this happen.
Right.
She's the one who always has the information he needs. She pulls his ass out of the fire more than once. And she's the one who brings the Falcon to everybody.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, really, she should have just taken the Falcon and gone. Been like, see ya, suckers. I'm out of here.
Yeah. No, now I feel like that's a thing we see.
That's Effie, right?
Yeah.
Effie is her name? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm going to give Gross Point Blank credit also for being a little bit of this. It's also about three movies in one. It's very Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. I think it's tipping its hat.
Yes,
those movies,
and it's got that. The main reason I bring it up is it's got the secretary trope because his sister Joan Cusack plays his secretary, and she's like that. She's kind of more in charge, knows more about what's going on.
That's the film noir stereotype, right?
Right.
You have the dame who pretends to be in trouble and distress, but secretly is got another plan.
Yeah.
And that's our main character. That's Ms. Astor, mm-hmm. Right? Bridget O'Shaughnessy. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the secretary who's super competent and probably has a little bit of a crush on the detective. But it's, you know, it's never going to go anywhere and they both know it. And that's Effie. And then Iva, who's the widow mm-hmm. of his partner, right. Miles, mm-hmm. is sort of the weak female character. And that's pretty much it. I mean, you don't have any other female characters in here.
No, and you have about as many male characters, and then that's your movie. Like that's like I said, it's a very claustrophobic,
yeah, it's lots very of single much rooms. Of time.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that at all. It felt very like a recent example would be Tarantino's Hateful Eight for me. Where that movie's even more so, but you know, trapping yourself in limited space and having hard dialogue between characters and not a lot of room to leave is interesting to me. I find that really riveting and whatever. And this movie does that really well.
Yeah, this movie makes good use of everything it shows you, and it's tight.
Yeah,
it is a whole. It is a movie that is a whole. I don't watch part of it and go, okay, now I'm waiting for the next part I like.
Right.
I was surprised that even now, I don't know how many times I've seen this, probably half dozen now. I was still carried along from moment to moment. You know, never once felt like I needed to pause and go get a snack or anything like that. Like it just carried me all the way through. And I actually watched it on a Saturday afternoon when I was like, well, I'm not sure if I'll get it all in one go. And I just couldn't put it down. I couldn't press stop. I was like, no, I have to swallow this all at once because it's that good of a story.
Yeah. What's crazy is I'm gonna do the math real quick. -$18.99. Okay, so Humphrey Bogart, I swear he always looks the same and he always looks 60 to me.
Just no, he was born looking like this, like he does in Maltese Falcon.
It's so weird to me, but he was only 42 in the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
He died very young at 57. And we've talked about this before and we've had him in other movies, but, or maybe it was just the other one, but this is, I think maybe my new favorite thing he's in. I like this version of his portrayal more than most because I don't know. Casablanca is just very, like it's just a lot of,
well, in Casablanca, he's beaten down by the world.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That's who he's playing.
Yeah.
He's playing a man who's done. He's like, yep, I lost my love. I lost my country. The world's a war. Screw it. I'm over. I'm done. I'm just going to be Rick and I'm going to run my cafe. Right. Whereas Maltese Falcon, he's a prosperous detective. You know, he's got his own beat. As long as he's got a good relationship with the cops. Up until the beginning of this movie, he has a competent partner that he can rely on and a competent secretary and everything's okay for him as long as people stay out of his way and let him do his job. So he's a much more positive character, even if he's slightly amoral about it.
Yeah. And he's got a lot of energy about it and he's just moving around like nothing's going to stop him. And it's very addicting. It's very fun to watch him in this role. I think it might be my favorite. Everything else just felt like he was super tired in it and droopy. And, you know, you see a caricature artist doing an image of Humphrey Bogart and it's always the droopy eyes and the barely moving.
And he only makes Casablanca a year later after this. This is 1941. Casablanca is 1942.
Yeah. I should see that as range. Like, ooh, look at his range. But instead I just see the two kinds now. I see his upbeat energy and then I see, feels like everything else. Well, I say that I've seen like maybe three Bogart movies ever. And so I just
and the caricature of him as a baby in Looney Tunes. Those are the only impressions you have.
Yeah, Looney Tunes always had it's so funny to think about it now because they were just making fun of their contemporaries, right? Yeah. They were having fun at the expense of who was Hollywood then. I look at it and it's just like a total fantasy to me. Like I don't even know who these people were, but I kind of recognize these voices they're doing, and I can tell that's Peter Lorre, even though I didn't know who Peter Lorre was when I was a kid. But yeah, Looney Tunes is what educated me.
Well, and Humphrey Bogart is all droopy. And right. Yeah.
It was really good. And if they ever did, who am I trying to think of? That's boo, 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 boo. I can't think of the singer.
Bing Crosby?
Bing Crosby was always just like
yep.
this ridiculous over-the-top Bing Crosby impression. And that was what I knew because I didn't know anything else. My grandparents would be like, oh, that's Humphrey Bogart. We loved him. And he was at the height of his career, this and that. And I'd think, is this, I don't know. It's just a cartoon to me with weird big lips and it's very odd. Very odd. Anyway, someone in the chat says, is it me or is this weird current geek? No, we do this twice a month, or we do this once a month for movies. I think some people still haven't heard
no,
this.
No, I wrote, it's just you. And Colitube wrote back, okay, I had a hunch.
Yeah, we don't.
It's a film episode. We're talking about the Maltese Falcon. And from a geeky perspective, obviously, because that's who we are. But a couple other things. Film received 3 nominations for Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Best Supporting Actor for Sidney Greenstreet. This was his first role on film. Mm. He was a stage actor up until this movie. And they had to kind of convince him, like, oh, yeah, you're the right man for the job. We want you.
Is he the big dude? He's the big dude.
Yeah, he's the fat man.
Let's take a look here. Born in 79, died in 54.
In 79, and you mean 1879.
1879, yeah. I'm trying to see if there's anything else I would
have
seen.
He's 3 years older than my grandpa.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like he worked from 41 to 49, so really nothing else I've seen him in.
Yeah, this is his first movie. You have seen him in Casablanca.
Oh, okay. He was in that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
All right. So he had a nice little career there for a bit. That's cool.
Yeah, he was a stage actor and happy to be so, and they kind of convinced him to do the movies, so he did movies during the 40s.
Plus, is there a cooler Hollywood name than Sidney Greenstreet? That's a badass name.
I mean, it can't be his real name, right?
My name is Sidney Greenstreet. Well, I'll tell you right here. British actor, blah, blah, blah. It says Sidney Hughes Greenstreet's his real name.
Oh, wow. For real.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little surprised too, but he was born in Sandwich, Kent, England.
Wow.
Sandwich.
And that's not a place named after sandwiches. It's the place named after the Earl who gave his name to sandwiches.
Right. Exactly. And also, this guy looked like he had a lot of sandwiches.
He didn't say no to a lot of sandwiches.
No, he had no self-control when it came to
Well, we
sandwiches.
Don't know that. Maybe he had a glandular disorder.
It could be anything. I'm not. I am definitely not in a position to say anything right now. I've got extra pounds I don't want. So me,
you,
and
my friend, need to say no to a couple sandwiches.
Yeah, me and Sidney Greenstreet are carrying around a little extra more than we wanted to. But hey,
you are no Sidney Greenstreet though. I've seen you in person recently. I can swear to that.
He was good though in this. Like really.
Yeah.
I found him like the prototype now for like Bond villains, and like I started thinking about all the kinds of stereotype dudes like that in movies from 41 and forward, and there's tons of them, and they all kind of act like him, whether he's just like, oh, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die, you know, like just that kind of guy. He is that guy.
Well, and he's such a nuanced evil, but even in Casablanca, he's not pure evil in either case. He's selfish evil in both these roles, and he's such a like, well, my friend, I'm sure gentlemen can come to an agreement. You know, like it's such a like, well, I will always be polite to your face, but I may stab you in the back or I may not. Depends on my self interest. Like it's a nuanced character, and I always love it.
Do you ever have? Did you also have a memory? I have a memory of seeing this when I was younger, and somebody got beaten over the head and killed with the Maltese Falcon. I must have that mixed up with something else, obviously.
That is definitely not in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember now.
Okay. For some reason, it's as clear as day in my head that somebody reached around and bonked somebody else in the head real hard with it and ended that dude with the Falcon in a hand, and I don't know why.
There's so many, so many of these fake false memories that we've created around the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, what is that called? We got the Mandela effect going on. That's what that is, maybe. I don't know.
It's not the Mandela effect,
isn't it? Where you thought you
saw
a thing?
That was what ended apartheid in South Africa.
Right. No, I know. No.
The Mandela effect has to do with circles, doesn't it?
No, I thought the Mandela effect was because everyone thought that Mandela died in prison, but he didn't. But people were sure of it, and then they started.
Oh, really?
That's
for real?
Yeah, and so then, like, the big common one is the Berenstain Bears versus the Berenstain Bears.
I take it back. You're right.
Yeah, I think that's it. Is how
memories
that
don't match our current reality and its history.
Yeah.
And the Mandela effect. I'm so wrong.
I think that's what I'm having on this with somebody getting killed.
I thought you were talking about the Mandela effect, which is a totally different thing.
No, I don't even know what that is. That's new to me.
That's a Jungian thing. Oh. This is the problem when you know things that no one else cares about. You remember those, and everybody else remembers the real things that everyone else cares about.
That's awesome. Well, all right then. I was trying to think, what was my point though? What was the Mandela? Oh, that I remember
Mandela
seeing a thing that
about
didn't happen.
The Maltese Falcon. Yeah, we've had two examples of it now, with it breaking open and having something inside, and somebody getting hit with it.
Yeah.
Neither one of which are in this movie. They might be in some other thing referencing the Maltese Falcon, but they're not here.
Now, unlike some people, I am not going to extrapolate that into a broader conspiracy that a timeline has changed and I am in a different timeline. Because in my old timeline, it actually happened where somebody got hit over the head with the Falcon.
But could be what it is.
Well, that's
could
the,
have to
that's
do
where a lot of people go. They're like, someone,
universe stuff.
Someone zapped me out of. Here's the other one. The end of the Queen song. Oh, I can't remember how it goes.
Bohemian Rhapsody?
Is it not Rhapsody? It's
Killer Queen?
It's not Killer Queen.
I'm in love with my car?
No. We just watched that movie. It was great. Is it Fat Bottom Girls? Maybe.
Fat Bottom Girls?
There's something where at the end of it, everyone's sure he sings a certain thing, but he doesn't. And when you hear the song, you cannot believe that he doesn't say it. Because in your memory, he absolutely says it. Like people would swear they'd sell their children and to say that they believe that. And then when you play the song, it's not.
Get on your bikes and ride.
That's it. No, I don't know what it is.
No, that's Bicycle. Never mind.
I just can't remember. At the very end, there's like a... I'm sidetracked by it, but if I could remember it, I would. Anyway, also go see Bohemian Rhapsody. That's a good movie, and Rami Malek's amazing.
Yes, sure. I agree.
Why
I'm
not?
Looking up Queen Mandela effect right now.
Yeah, we're having
now that I know what the Mandela effect actually is.
Now, we are on a roll here of films I haven't seen. Next movie is definitely one I have not seen. 12 Angry Men. In my head, 12 Angry Men is Glengarry Glen Ross or something. Like, I've got it all mixed up with about 10 other movies. So just speaking of the Mandela effect, I'm going to be even more jacked up with 12 Angry Men.
Is it We Are the Champions of the World?
Yes. At the end it says, We are the champions. We are the champions. We are the champions of the world. He doesn't say of the world at the end. But everyone is sure that he does until you hear it and you go, oh, he doesn't. So what would you say? Would you say he does or doesn't?
I would have said he does, yeah.
All right, I'm going to play it.
Does he say it anywhere in the song?
In the song, there are there are instances of it in the song.
Okay, so that's what I'm remembering. And the idea that he says it at the end is just us transferring it from the middle of the song.
And I think that's what everybody's hearing. So I'm just going to do this real quick. Hold on. Okay, so we know the beginning. All right. Here we go. We are the champions. And then he should say, nothing.
It feel like it's missing, doesn't it?
Just ends. Oh, it's so weird.
Oh, hey, but before we get on to 12 Angry Men.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to.
And I know we're just teasing it for next time.
Yeah.
I want to tell a little story, just a very short story. When I first moved to San Francisco.
Oh, I love a good short story.
I was very nervous and very excited. It was the biggest city I had ever lived in. And one of the things that fascinated about me is I was a huge Raymond Chandler fan, and I also was a Dashiell Hammett fan, although Raymond Chandler first. And I was excited that San Francisco was where Sam Spade had been set. And so I was super excited to be like, oh, I'm going to be in actual San Francisco. And even though there's not a scene in The Maltese Falcon that didn't happen on the lot or on a soundstage, just the idea of being in there. And one of the first things I did after I moved to San Francisco was I went and ate at John's Grill. John's Grill is a real restaurant that was referenced in the Dashiell Hammett novel, The Maltese Falcon, about where Sam Spade went to eat some lamb chops and sliced tomatoes before heading out on one of his. I think when he goes out and gets called away, you know, down to South San Francisco, I think it's where he ate before that. It's referenced in the book. I was always sad that they don't reference it in the movie. I would love to see him go into John's Grill. But it's still there. John's Grill's there. They have a Falcon in there that you can go take a look at. just pictures of Humphrey Bogart up on the wall, and you can order the rack of lamb and sliced tomatoes. They still have it on the menu.
That is such a man's meal, isn't it? Or from, I mean, like a 40s and 50s man's meal. Like, give me the usual there, Sarah, or whatever, and she brings
rack
you
rack of lamb and the sliced tomatoes. And make
sliced tomatoes. That's awesome. I would go there if I was in the neighborhood and totally check that out. And it's still like, you know, off, you know, people can go there. Like, it's not a
museum.
Last
time I was in San Francisco, it was still there, still kicking. You know, they do a brisk business. Tourists come in and want to eat a rack of lamb and sliced tomatoes. They have other things on the menu if you're not that nostalgic about that, you know.
This is a lovely little anecdote that you brought us today.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool thing to be like, oh, man, I live in a city with history now. I live in a city with, you know, references and things. It was a really fun part of that.
Right. Yeah. I guess there's less of that in our small town upbringing, but take us out to San Francisco.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's lots of history in Greenville. It's just only people in Greenville care about.
Right.
Not anybody else.
That's a good point. All right. Well, there you go. That's our Dear Martha moment for the show today.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, well done. All right. 12 Angry Men. That's next time. That's next month. June, Brian, Tom.
Yeah.
June.
And never seen it.
Oh, good. I haven't either.
I've never watched it.
Good. Yeah. I won't feel so alone in my...
And this is definitely one of those movies that gets referenced, right? To where I know like the gist of it just by like, oh, it's like 12 Angry Men in there because, you know, blah, 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 blah. So,
And I don't know a ton about it, but isn't it like... It's jurors, right? It's jurors trying to do a thing.
This is the quintessential, as I understand it, this is the quintessential movie about how justice can be affected by our own beliefs, prejudices, mistakes, and how, you know, people can go in thinking they're fair and balanced and get persuaded.
Wow. And I assume not unlike this week's claustrophobic affair, because they're going to all be in the room, right? Deliberating for most of the film. Yeah, we don't know. We haven't seen it. So we're going to see it together. And it's going to be great. Well, not together. Apart, but then back together when we talk about it, which will be awesome. So look forward to that. That's in the very early bits of June. In fact, usually the first week in June. So check that out. 12 Angry Men from 1957. Available lots of places.
We will not be watching the sequel, 12 Satisfied Men.
Oh, it was such a bummer.
Or the 12 Now Happy Men.
Right. 12 Mediocre Men.
Those were the straight-to-video VHS versions.
They were in the 80s. They really just lost their way. It wasn't great.
12 Miffed Men. Just didn't have pack the punch.
12 Slightly Agitated Men.
Yeah. 12 Men who'd really rather be home eating dinner.
Yeah, which is... Isn't that really all of us at the end of the day? It's pretty much all of us. Anyway, that's next time. Also, stick around for the end of this episode because Legal Geek's got what you need because he's covering the recent Supreme Court decision on whether copyright registration must be finalized by the Copyright Office before you can sue for infringement in federal court.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a thing you'd be into, Tom Merritt, a little bit. Just the whole...
It in fact is.
Do you like being labeled for your whole tech coverage life as the guy who likes to talk about copyright stuff? Is that annoying?
I mean, that could do worse.
Yeah. Like, you could,
I
be,
could be the guy who likes to talk about something inconsequential that no one cares about. And so,
fart jokes in the morning on the morning show.
It's
That's
not inconsequential, even if no one cares about it.
Oh, there's definitely consequences, but nobody cares. Hey, I care. I care, man.
Thanks, man. All I care about your fart jokes. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Next week, it'll be back to the current geek format you also know and love, where we talk about current events and stuff happening. So that's next week, and then we'll do another autopilot after that. Very exciting stuff coming up for Current Geek here in the month of May. I think that's going to do it for us. Tom, anything you want to mention before we go?
Yeah, if you're a person, and I assume you are, if you're listening to this, and you think, ha, Tom does other things, I only listen to Current Geek. Or maybe you're like, I listen to Tom on Current Geek and Daily Tech News Show, but he does other things beyond that. How does he do it? Well, I don't attempt to explain how, but I tell you what, every week in the Free Tom newsletter at freetomnewsletter.com, it lists the Current Geek episodes. It will always list my Cord Killers episodes about TV and movies, Sword and Laser, Let's Talk About Star Wars, any guest appearances, when I'll be traveling places. If you want to get together and hook up at an appearance here and there, you know, I do leave the house from time to time. So go subscribe at freetomnewsletter.com. Casablanca.com.
Everyone I know is doing one of those. I'm feeling peer pressure to make one, and I don't know why. I just feel
it.
Maybe I will do it. But for now, Tom's is the only one you need. So go check it out. And Jury's is okay. There's other people making
these ones. Yeah, the politics one's pretty great.
It's not bad. If you're into politics, I guess, which seems like is the thing to do right now. Anyway, do that. Also, check out frogpants.com for other great shows on the network, including The Morning Stream, which I mentioned before. Tom comes on that show and guest stars on there on Wednesday mornings. He's going to do that tomorrow. It's always good. So check that out as well. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for all of you. Have a fantastic week, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we review an important Supreme Court copyright law decision from a few weeks ago, dealing with the requirements for enforcing your copyright in federal court. The case we cover today is Fourth Estate Public Benefit Corporation versus WallStreet.com, but the facts of the case are not as important as the overlying rule in dispute. The Supreme Court took on this case to settle a split of decisions going opposite ways in the circuit courts in various regions of the country. The split was over whether a finalized copyright registration is required to sue someone for copyright infringement in the federal courts, or whether a filing of an application is sufficient to allow you into federal court. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that finalized registration after review by the Copyright Office is a prerequisite to suing a third party in court to enforce the copyright. It has long been understood that federal registration is the Wonka's golden ticket into federal court, along with providing several other important legal benefits. But this decision confirms that a mere application filing is not enough. Copyrights are covered only by federal law, so federal court is the only place to enforce such rights. The copyright registration process can take a few weeks or a few months. While this is not a ton of time in the overall intellectual property landscape, these delays can be significant when a profitable work has been knocked off, and you seek to enforce copyright to stop that knockoff. As such, the impetus is now on authors and creators to register their works with the U.S. Copyright Office as early as possible, not just wait until the competitor infringes. Copyright is a natural legal right that immediately attaches to a creative work as soon as it is fixed in a tangible medium, which can be as simple as saving a Word document draft on a computer hard drive. However, ownership of a copyright does not entitle a copyright holder to enforcement rights in court, and that's where federal registration in the U.S. kicks in. The point of requiring registration is to help prove authorship and the right to claim the copyright before that issue would need to be litigated in a court. Justice Ginsburg, writing for the court, also noted that reading the law the other way would not make sense because it would allow for wasted efforts where the Copyright Office refuses registration, but a lawsuit has already been ongoing in the meantime. Pragmatic examples like this helped win the day at the court during oral arguments, and then in the final written opinion. The bottom line is, if you're worried about potential competitors or knockoffs taking your copyrighted work, the Supreme Court has sent the message loud and clear. Register those works early, or face the risk of delay before you can even file a lawsuit in federal court against an infringer. The Supreme Court often steps in when the appeals circuit courts cannot agree on a law like this, and now we have clarity for the requirements to enter federal court. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.